Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. The contemplative life of a Buddhist or a non-Buddhist, any kind of contemplative life, requires a certain type of character, I suppose, a character who is willing to take responsibility for their own actions, speech, and thoughts and emotions. And that sense of personal responsibility for how one behaves and how the mind is responding or reacting is a reflective activity, which you could call contemplation. A person who doesn't take responsibility for the behavior and tends to focus outwards through distraction, blame, or blaming parents or whatever one does, and doesn't really take responsibility for the inner world or their outer manifestation, that person is really blocked from any kind of significant spiritual life because they're dependent on externalities and they don't really see where the source of discontent resides, and that's in the human heart. And to be a contemplative is that strong sense of satya or truthfulness. We say that of all the baramis that the Buddha developed over many, 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 many lifetimes, the one barami he could not go against, or the one virtuous quality he could not go against, was truthfulness, satya barami. And satya barami isn't self-disparagement or self-criticism. It's not being like, I'm terribly honest about myself. It's just taking responsibility for the cause and effect nature of one's thinking, of one's acting, one's speaking. And self-disparagement, self-criticism is rooted in what we call vibhava tanha, which is a deep kind of existential dismissal of our own being, our own personality, and which is a great problem in Western culture. It's not just vibhava tanha is one of the three cravings, just to go back. So in Buddhist contemplative life, we take as our theme, kind of depends, if you're not suffering, if your mind is feeling quite clear and tranquil and centered, then the basic contemplation, I think, is between the conditioned and the unconditioned. So that there is the unconditioned, there is the conditioned, there is the unborn, there is the born. There is the formulated and constructed, there's the not constructed. There is the dependently originated, there's that which is not dependently originated. This is the language of transcendence. And this is the contemplative exercise one does if one, is deeply interested in the Buddhist path. And that happens when the mind has a lot of clarity. But usually the kind of contemplative theme that we pick up is around suffering, because we all want to be free from suffering. We don't like unhappiness. We were kind of built to seek happiness or fulfillment or in whatever ways, whether it's emotional, physical, in relationships, through the mind. We're kind of built to find that. So when we suffer, there's a very natural response to suffering. How do I get rid of this? How do I get out of this? If there's not a contemplative attitude to suffering, then there's just some kind of quick reaction of either anger or blame or sense distraction or going into thinking or getting depressed or running away from it, blaming, all manner of reactions that we can have to human suffering. But the contemplative makes conscious the feeling of discontent. That's a big step to actually bring into consciousness, to allow to become conscious the very feelings of discontent which we want to get rid of. The reason you need to do that, obviously, is that if we don't make conscious the discontent we feel, and we simply react through blame or distraction, then we don't really understand what the problem is. We're simply reactive, and those reactions become cyclical, patterned behavior that just manifests in the same way again and again and again and again. So there's no freedom there, there's no liberation. So the contemplative attitude is making conscious the very feeling of discontent that we might have. It might be a minor or a major. It might be just some little sense of boredom. It might be rage. It might be a little bit of anxiety. It might be terror. It might be just a hankering for a sandwich in the afternoon in the monastery. It might be strong, strong lust. So there's, you know, various ways in a spectrum of possibilities that discontent can arise. And so the contemplatives, in Buddhist contemplation, the contemplative is very much attentive to that. Any mode of discontent really pays attention to that and tries to make it conscious. And making something conscious isn't just thinking about it. I might feel discontent about someone or something, or myself, my own behavior, my own personality, about the weather, all manner of things I might feel discontent about. Just to think that I shouldn't feel discontent and just to go off in some kind of self-thinking isn't making it conscious. It's just being caught with it. Or just criticizing myself or analyzing it all the time. You're just thinking about it. It isn't making it conscious. Making something conscious is you have to just let the very feeling of this come up into consciousness. So it's rather like looking at the trees, beautiful trees and the beautiful sunshine this afternoon. You can look at the landscape, you can look at the treescape, and you can comment on it. Say, isn't that beautiful? What a beautiful color. I should have brought my camera. Isn't that fantastic? But that's not really making conscious the color of the trees. That's not making conscious the natural environment. It's thinking about it. When you make something conscious, take beauty. If you make conscious beauty, what do? You look at it. You allow it to come into the sense field. It manifests in whatever way it manifests. And there, in that manifestation, if you are patient and just allow it to manifest, you see things. You notice things. So I was out on the bench and I was looking at, you know, we had a beautiful sun in the west behind the bench. So the trees on the eastern side of the pond, there was a lot of yellow maples, and they were just glowing with the sunshine. And then all around it was the field and the greens. And just allowing my attention just to be with that for a long period of time. All kinds of things. You notice the different shades of green, the different shapes of green, the different shades of yellow, the cloudscapes, the different grays in the cloud and so on. And this wasn't through analysis or thinking, it was just by allowing attention to be with the beautiful. In this case, for me, it was very attractive. And allowing the mind just to be with that, to make conscious this experience of beauty, as I defined it then. And then things are noticed, you notice things. It's very easy to pay attention to beauty. It's much more difficult to pay attention to discontent. It's the same exercise, it just takes a much more courageous, much more determined, much more maybe determined willingness to really engage with this discontent rather than dismiss it, analyze it, blame it, judge it, or seek some kind of sense gratification to distract it. It's this willingness, this determination to engage with making conscious that which I would rather not have, which I'd rather would go away. And when we make conscious the various discontent that we feel in the mind, then we are led to the Four Noble Truths. Because this is really the basis of Buddhist contemplation, is to actually take that which, as Longpo Samhita said, that which we really don't want, the least thing we want, suffering, and engage with it in a meaningful and mindful way, so that we understand it, so that we can go beyond it. It's brilliant, brilliant strategy. And so the engagement with discontent is not just intellectual, it's existential. It's like when I'm engaged with the landscape this afternoon, I'm not engaging with it intellectually, but I am engaging with it. I'm engaging it with at the level of sense organs, at the level of mind, but not in the level of just commentary. Commentary might come and go, but that's not the main thing. The main thing is to let the landscape come to me, to let the colors come to me, to be open and available to that configuration of nature. And then something is seen, something is learned. And you try that with beauty. See how even just beauty, how restless we can get. You know, you look for a few minutes and then you start to fidget around. But actually hold attention on something like that. It's a very good exercise in how to sustain attention in an open-hearted way to that which is. It just is. Now it is attractive. So there is that. But you know, if you just hold your attention, after a while the attraction goes and it becomes more neutral, but in a way it's still quite attractive. So in the same way, when discontent arises, the challenge is to let that, as I say, come into consciousness. And we are faced with the problem of desire. And so in the formulation of the contemplation of discontent or suffering or whatever mode it comes up in, the important thing is to see that the cause of suffering is attachment to craving. And these are technical terms, bhava tanha, vibhava tanha, kama tanha. Bhava tanha is the craving to become, vibhava tanha is the craving to get rid of, and kama tanha is the craving to always absorb in pleasurable sense objects, sense experience. And that, you know, that's that contemplation you've all heard many, 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 many times before. But it's quite important that in your observation of life, in your contemplation life, that the intention you make, if it's going to be an authentic Buddhist practice, the intention you make in your meditation, in walking around, is grounded in this contemplation of dukkha and the end of dukkha. So it can be grounded in the contemplation of the conditioned and the unconditioned, which is a corollary, really, of the Four Noble Truths. There is the condition, there's the unconditioned. The condition always leads you to is always unsatisfactory. And the unconditioned is the realization of that which is beyond unsatisfactoriness. So there can be that, and that's a very Theravada Buddhist contemplation. And so what one has to look at one's life is my intention towards that? Is my intention towards contemplation of the transcendent? Or is my attention just caught up in self-analysis and self-criticism and so on? And then the other way, the contemplation of dukkha, is then when dukkha does arise, when there is discontent, is my intention, is the way I pay attention to understand suffering, and specifically the attachment to craving. This would be right view and right intention coming from a sense of the Four Noble Truths and a sense of how to work with that. Now, if one's intellect, if one's structure of contemplation isn't clear, then it can be very hit and miss affair. One can be doing all kinds of things, but the intention to liberate the heart from suffering, if that's not clear, one can be doing good things, but still maybe building up a different kind of an ego than the ego that's already there, or doing some kind of practice out of a sense of duty. So if I feel angry at someone, no, I should like them and do metta practice, just as some kind of Buddhist reflex. But rather than really contemplating anger, relationship, anger, discontent, conflict, what is it really like to make it conscious? Whereas it's just a knee-jerk Buddhist reaction, I have to do metta practice. But sure, do metta practice, but not out of some sense of duty, but because it makes sense. Because in my contemplative life, I see that kind of consideration helps in terms of all the aversions we have. So the considerations around tanha, then in contemplate like vibhava tanha is the desire not to have. And I think for me, it's different than aversion. I think vibhava, all these words, you know, they're just words. There's no absolute definition to them. And all these ways that we talk about mind states, there's always a spectrum. So it's like anger. You could think about being annoyed at someone because they did something in the kitchen, or you can have a really, really be, you know, want to murder someone because they hurt your parents or something like that. There's a whole range, right? In anger or fear or lust. So vibhava tanha, I think there's something about it that is not just like a superficial annoyance. I think it's like an existential not wanting of this moment the way it is. I think there is something about it that can be, you know, it's about existence and this moment, and I just don't want this moment to be here like this. So it could be around your own personality, and that would, you know, if you took the spectrum or the range of possibilities around your own personality, vibhava tanha could be the precursor to suicide. I mean, I really don't like this guy, I'm going to get rid of him. Or it could be less extreme. It could be just this like self-loathing. One hears about things like self-loathing, just a kind of deep, deep self-loathing. Or it could be just a constant nagging self-criticism. Shouldn't be like this, shouldn't be like that. And constant nagging self-criticism of personality. Or it could be, you know, just a kind of once in a while kind of a thing. So there'd be a whole spectrum there. But I think what it points to is this deep sense of not wanting this life to be the way it is right now, whether it's one's personality. It might be one's social life. Social life might be very complicated with in-laws and marriage or kids or mortgages or, you know, a whole range of things. It might be so complicated with all the complexities. It'd be such a headache that the whole attitude to one's social life situation would be, I just don't want this. I don't want this life of mine. And then the variations of that to a lesser degree. So it could be about that. It could be about the environment. You know, one felt really upset about the environment. And so there's all manner of ways that might manifest. But it's basically this feeling, I don't want this. I just don't want this. And you can see, if one isn't attentive to that, then this moment is always being, the reaction to this moment is always being driven by vibhava tanha. And if you don't see that, there's no way out. Always there would be a rejection of this moment. And what we're trying to do in mindfulness practice is really make conscious this moment. Not that you like it. It's not like, you know, like, that this moment's going to be that moment in the afternoon. That's a peak experience. That doesn't happen very much, especially October, middle of October, right? And so that's, it's not about like enjoying your tangerine. You know, I'm going to really be mindful of this tangerine, feel the juiciness of my tangerine. That's just kamatana. That's just sensual indulgence. But this sense of this moment is this way. You make it conscious. And then from that, especially in those times where you just want to get rid of life, you just don't want life to be this way, it's very hard to make it conscious. Very, very hard to make it conscious. One would rather blame oneself, others, distract, do something. So just the very yucky feeling that we get about life sometimes, in a major way or a minor way, to allow that to become conscious. And what happens if you do that? Well, you'll find, first of all, it's hard to do. You'd rather, like it's more difficult to, I think it's more difficult to feel a feeling of self, lack of self-worth. To actually feel that, it's more difficult just to hold that than to hate yourself. To hate yourself is very easy, you just think. You're dumb. Hopeless, hopeless, hopeless. That's easy. Because that's just thought. But actually to hold a feeling of self-loathing or lack of self-respect or some memory you have of something that you think you would have done wrong, and you get that awful feeling of you know, hurt someone or whatever you think, right? To actually hold that in consciousness, to bear witness to it, means you have to go against vibhava tanha. Now vibhava tanha just wants to get rid of that memory, that person, that personality, this body state, this social situation. And it's an energy which is hard to bear with, because all craving is hard to bear with. Unfulfilled craving is very hard to bear with. So you're with something that's terribly uncomfortable. And but what you face then is the yuckiness of that mind state, the hopeless feeling maybe of the social situation. Now you can do substitute program on it. You can say, it'll be all right, it'll be all right, it'll be all right. And that's helpful, I suppose. But the kind of guts of the practice is to go right into those difficulties. Now, if someone is getting clinically depressed, one wouldn't recommend that. You would never do that. This is graduate work, by the way. This is a PhD program we're involved in. We're not undergrads here, where we're just trying to become nice people. We're trying to go beyond being a person, beyond all the personality stuff. And so these are very important moments when there are strong feelings of vibhava tanha. First of all, to make it conscious, to recognize this is tanha, this is craving, not wanting to be who you are, not wanting to be where you are, not wanting to be the social situation you have, not wanting the cancer, or, you know, these are the extremes. And life often is an extreme, but they do come out, they do come out. And to hold that with full awareness, in its major or minor themes, is the way of liberating the mind from that tendency towards vibhava tanha. And so the third noble truth is the cessation of that. You know, when you're with a yucky feeling or a difficult mindset, and you're willing to bear witness to it, and it goes through you, and it goes through you, and goes through you, and you'll be very, very patient, be very, very truthful and honest, it goes through you. When that vibhava tanha begins to cease and the fuel no longer feeds it, what you find is all the mentality around that, all the papancha, the proliferation around vibhava tanha, that falls away too. And life becomes acceptable. It's not great, maybe, but why should it be? And why should everything be beautiful sunny days? Can't be. But it's all right. It's okay. Because you found that in your heart, that's where the true peace is. It's not around pleasure. It's not around getting what you want. It's not around having a great personality. You know, you just got this personality. That's all right. You don't have to have all that. So that's vibhava tanha. And you have your own take on it. This is just my take on it. You have your own take. Now, I know when my mother died, I was really exhausted. I often talk about this, but one only has one life, so you get the same stories. But when my mother died, I was very, very, very exhausted. And I wasn't, like, I loved my mom. I tell this to people, in 9 years of being with her, I had one disagreement, which lasted 15 minutes. So you can see, we had a very easy, to say the least, easy relationship, very loving. So there was nothing like in the caring of her, it was very beautiful, but, you know, the nervous system has limitations. So when I came here after she died, I was so negative. And it wasn't like I was grieving her loss. I was relieved that she was, she was released from the pain of that terribly old body, and she was too. But it was just the negativity of emotional exhaustion. And it came up really awful. This kind of awful states of mind. It was critical and angry and depressed and just yucky. And nothing in me wanted to be with that. You know, nothing wanted to be, yet it was obvious that's what you got to be with. So I just did a lot of walking meditation. I overslept a lot, and I ran around the pond. I just didn't have to really meditate. I just had to give it space. Unfortunately, Ajahn Kusala was very generous, and everyone loved me. And so for 2 months, it felt crappy. It was absolutely terrible. And intellectually, I kept trying to figure out what's wrong. But emotionally, I mean, there's nothing wrong. This is what crappy feels like. But because I could bear witness to it, then eventually it lifted and I was elated. I had an incredibly happy, peaceful mind. Now that happy, peaceful mind wasn't that I produced something called happiness and peace. No, it was because I allowed this suffering to manifest. You know, I let it come into consciousness, so make it conscious, and I had enough training to do that. And then I kept attention on vibhava tanha, this desire not to have this. I don't want this. I want to get rid of it. No, but it's this way, it's this way, it's this way, it's this way. Oh, but I don't know, it's this way. Constant mantra, and then just walking up and down and being with it. And, you know, Ajahn Kusala was a bit worried about me. But I wasn't. I just kind of knew, no. You know. So at one level, I was kind of concerned intellectually, and that's where thought just doesn't work. You can't figure this out. You just have to let it run its course. Well, that's an extreme. And so the peace that comes from that is different than the peace of distraction. Right? The peace that comes from that is the peace of purification, of liberation, of letting go of non-grasping. The road is bumpy. The road is bumpy. But if one has, then, if one has an intellectual structure within which one approaches that problem through the Buddha's recommendations, then you'll be on the right track, called right practice, the path. But if one doesn't, if one hasn't really taken deeply these Four Noble Truths, its cause and its end, contemplated these types of tanha deeply, then quite often the equipment which governs intention, the equipment that governs the way we pay attention, that's not finely honed, it's not rightly tuned, it's not directed in the right way, and it misapprehends the situation. There's something wrong. But so you keep going back. Well, what's the craving now? I feel crappy. No, you feel crappy, but what's the craving? Oh, the craving, I don't want to feel crappy. That's Buddha Dhamma. The other is just personal preference, and who wants to feel rotten? So it takes a lot of guts to do this. It takes a lot of patience and truthfulness. There's no blame here. There's nothing right or wrong. It's just tanha has arisen dependent on this particular negative situation. And then one can do things, you know, you can watch a Laurel and Hardy movie if you want, I couldn't, or music, it's all right, nothing wrong with that. But if the intention is not to bear witness to vibhava tanha and just to suppress that, it won't work, I haven't paid your dues. That's vibhava. And think about it, you know, I mean, whatever way I'm sure you have comprehended it or thought about it different ways, but it can be very deep, this deep sense of, I don't want this birth, I don't want this existence. And it's different than being world weary. World weary is a term we use, and that's just being tired of the khandhas, tired of emotionality, tired of sensuality, tired of thought, in a way where you don't want to go there anymore. That's a wholesome state of mind. You don't want to go into the khandhas because you're interested in the unconditioned. The khandhas are the conditioned, you're interested in the unconditioned. That's world weary. That's a wholesome type, nibbida. It's a wholesome mind state. Where the vibhavatana is very unwholesome. It's very grounded in like getting rid of, not wanting, and so you have to make that conscious. Open up to Bhava tanha is I think it's more deep than just hankering for ice cream cone or something like that. So there's like sensual desire that we have that we talk about, but I think bhava is like a deep existential, again I use that, that's where I was sort of, that's the language I learned as a university student, so I use that word a lot. But for me, like it's about existence. It's not just a superficial thing. It's like deeply, deeply rooted. So bhava can be seen as like this always trying to be something else or somewhere else, or always like it can be manifest as like from fear, always worried about the future, trying to predict the future, trying to control the future, always being another person at another time in another situation, rather than here and now with this situation. It can be around creativity, always making things and constructing things and building things and doing things and planning things, always out into the future? Can we just fantasizing about some pleasurable experience, which is going to have sexual fantasy in the future? It can be about becoming enlightened, even that, you know, this kind of project of getting enlightened in the future, sometime in the future. So really working on myself to get something in the future. Becoming. Think of it in your own ways. That which is always moving to the future, which is not present to the way things are, that has to be made conscious. You have to make conscious this very movement in a virtual time into some kind of future virtual reality. It never comes. How many times have you and I lived a life we've never lived? Think about it, huh? And so making that conscious, like this is a movement to the future all the time. Where is that? What is that? And just And one of the real essence, I think, of the transcendent realization is that the present moment is all you got. And the belief in time, the belief in memory, the belief in future projection, those are conventions that we use. Sure, I have to think about my lift from the retreat to town because I'm going to meet Ajahn Pasano on Friday when he comes in. Yeah, that's the conventional reality I deal with, and that's conventional time, and that's the stuff we do. But deeply, like more deeply, the sense of existential future, that we have to see as something that arises in the present moment. And so present moment awareness is very, very significant in all spiritual practices. T.S. Eliot's The Intersection of the Timeless with Time, that man's curiosity searches past and future and clings to that dimension, but to apprehend the intersection of the timeless with time is the occupation of a saint. And I could forget the rest. No occupation either, but a life lived in love, selflessness, and self-surrender, something like that. But that, you know, that you find it in poetry, you find it in mystic traditions, you find it in Eckhart Tolle's Power of Now, very important, very important. And you see that in conventional reality, we have chronological time, you know, so we have a morning, we have an evening puja at 7 o'clock, and 5 o'clock, whatever time we have at breakfast, and yeah, we have chronological time, undoubtedly. And that's the convention, that man's curiosity searches past and future and clings to that dimension, to the dimension of time. But to apprehend the intersection of the timeless with time, which is now, is the occupation of a saint. And that occupation means that bhava tanha, this movement of becoming, will take us away from the present moment. This present moment, we won't be with it. We'll always be moving to some becoming something better, more skilled, more beautiful, and so on. So becoming. So all our practices around Buddhism, even like practices to be a better person, are about being in the present moment. So if I'm someone who's very distracted in some kind of way, not distraction is wrong. No, how can I be in the present moment? If my distraction is always because I'm restless and I always need to do something because I'm restless, it's not that the restlessness is so bad, but that movement to the future prevents me from abiding in deep stillness in the present moment. So we have samadhi. So we have practices of really getting your meditation or your life in the present moment, doing it. And bhava, for me at least, bhava is that movement away from the present moment to some future possibility. It might be positive, it might be negative, it might be based on fear. And then they go back and forth, don't they? So you have the past, cling to that dimension. So I have some fearful situation which happened to me, then I project in the future, it'll happen again. We need to plan, and we need to do those conventional things, but the transcendent, the intersection of time is with time, is like really seeing the importance of that. And so if you understand that importance of time and the use of chronological time, but the limitations of time, and realize that awareness can only be in the present moment, you start to make intentions towards that. You begin to get to the insight around time and the timelessness of the present moment. You begin to inquire into that. And your intentionality, sankhapa, is based upon that. So there's bhava, vibhava, getting rid of. And kamatanha is it's sensuality, it's hedonism, it's always absorbing into sense experience. They combine with each other, but just in our culture, it's all become very obvious, just the kind of the way people need to tweet all the time or check their internet. That's kamatanha, constantly looking at objects. Now what's wrong with that? Am I just an old fuddy-duddy saying, young kids are... No. It's not so much that. It's just that the attention is on the conditioned. And as long as attention is on the conditioned, you will not have space, awareness, possibility of the unconditioned. And as long as attention is on the conditioned, you're always caught in that which is born and dying, birth and death. And that's the source of dukkha, that which is pleasurable and displeasurable. So pleasure and displeasure are fine. That's not... Buddhism isn't a kind of philosophy of not thinking there's beauty in the world or that it's wrong. It's just pointing to that there is a transcendent realization. A transcendent realization means you have to abide in non-grasping with the conditioned realm. As long as I don't know how to abide in a way of non-grasping of the conditioned realm, and I grasp it through distraction and whatever, through thought, then there's no space for the realization of the transcendent. And so always the mind will be gravitating towards that which is suffering. So take something like after my mom died, right, the craving mind, what it wanted to do was to absorb into anything to not have this terribly difficult feeling. And it wasn't grieving, it was just deep, deep negativity, existential negativity. So that's what the craving mind was seeking, some kind of object, to alleviate this terrible, terrible, ugh. I wish I could put my face on there, how it felt. But what happens if you don't do that? What happens if you don't do that? Well, the yucky condition comes up. It manifests, and that's the khandhas are manifesting now. And the khandhas, I've related to the khandhas, to emotions and feelings and thoughts and memory and bodily things and smells and all of that. I've related to all of these before, maybe I've related to through craving. And now something difficult comes up and I don't relate it through craving, I actually look at the craving. I look at the craving and I contemplate this will change. This will change. And I bear with the craving. When the craving ceases, I begin to get a taste of the transcendent. Why? Because now the peace of mind that I have, the stillness of being that is there, I begin to notice that's the background to the conditioned realm, and I can enter into that background if I just let go of this pull towards the khandhas. If I just let go of craving, or I bear witness to it. And that's the insight of the Third Noble Truth. The end of suffering has to be realized. So what was the end of suffering there? The end of suffering was, sure, those mental states worked their way out, but I saw that the end of suffering was the end of the craving. Now what craving does, craving says to you, if you get, when you get an object which fulfills your craving, a person, a situation, you think, well, if I, it's the object that actually put an end to my craving. So let's say I'm sitting out there, it's very beautiful, and I don't have any craving, it's lovely, and I think, oh, the reason I didn't have any craving was because of the beauty. So I've got to get beauty all the time. No, the reason that I was happy was that there was no craving. It's the end of craving we're looking at. The deluded mind always thinks, well, if I get what I want, in terms of people or emotional situation, forget what I want, then I'll be happy. And we don't notice that even if we get what we want, soon enough, there's some discontent, and we seek another thing. So what we're seeking is not an object. We're seeking the end of craving. This is where you find freedom. Not that, again, not that objects are bad. You know, I hope that tomorrow morning you don't put salt in my coffee or vinegar on my oats or something. It's wrong. It's just that it's limited. It's very, very limited. So when we can wake up to craving and feel its power over us and just bear witness to it, bear witness to it, and then watch when it ceases, your mind doesn't want anything. So it's gotten peace not because it got what it wanted. No, no. It got not wanting. Get it? It got not wanting. It's the end of it. And that you have to realize. You have to notice that. You have to observe that taking place. So the, you know, as we work on our own business of being human, do contemplate, like when you sit in meditation, what kind of intentions do you put forth when you sit? And are they in line with the Four Noble Truths? Do you make any intentions? Are there clear intentions about why do you sit? Why do you meditate? Why do this business? What has it got to do with letting go and craving? And just that much clarity on intention is very important. You know, I can sit and meditate and have some kind of idea I want to get something and not even notice that, not be clear about it. So if my meditation is infected by craving, it's not the Four Noble Truths. It won't give you a good result. And if I don't notice that, I can be trying and be very, very diligent in my trying, but I don't notice there's actually already craving in the way I pay attention. That won't work. So I have to wake up, okay. Am I just trying to get something in my meditation? Or am I waking up to the way things are? And then am I using my meditation object to sustain the awake mind moment by moment? Free from craving. Free from craving. That you have to look at that, don't you? So, you know, really getting a good feeling for the Four Noble Truths and what right understanding is and what right intention is terribly important, terribly important. As long as attention, the way I tend to things is based upon craving to get rid of, to become, or I'm always just distracted by sense things that I still haven't really understood the problem is. And that clarity of direction is very important. So intellect is important, but we're not trying to solve this through thought. We're using thought as a kind of directing of the mind, then we let go of thought and we notice. And we bear witness to unfulfilled craving. And you have to realize that cessation, how things cease, you know, how something ceases, when a thought ceases, the ego ceases, how wanting ceases. Begin to actually contemplate the end of a thought, the end of a day, the space between a thought, where the whole sense of a self falls away. And that's the intersection of the timeless with time. If you look at self, that's always in time. Me who I was and me who I will become. But when you let go of self-thinking and there just is the way things are, that's the intersection of times with time, the present moment awareness. All right, let's finish there.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.